Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's the start of a new academic year for hand fellowships. So that's always exciting.
Today was day one, and I have to say it was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're fortunate always to get fantastic fellows in our program. And we had two of our fellows start this year. And we typically have three, but one's joining us a little bit later this year. And the two fellows that have started are fantastic. And it's been great to show our appreciation to last year's fellows as well. We had a nice series of graduation events this last weekend.
You know, a couple of things about that. First, thanks. You did a great job of kind of planning a graduation weekend. That's kind of a first, I guess I would say. And, I have been pushing the department to support all these financially because it just feels so right. I mean, all of us as hand partners getting together feels great. And obviously celebrating our fellows, you know, it was really fun. And it was great. It was a great weekend.
Yeah, we started with a graduation dinner at one of our favorite restaurants in the area. Had a nice space back there. Had some graduation toasts from the faculty for the outgoing fellows, and then we continued it the Boyer tradition of the pool party. But as many of you know, I have a pool now, so it's now the D family pool party, which was a ton of fun to do.
Yeah, you did a great job with that pool. I wish I could get rid of my pool, but your kids are the right age to enjoy it, and I know they are.
There's a lot of jumping off of the various things around here, and they had a great time. My son kept asking me why I wasn't getting in the pool because it's a pool party. And so I was talking to my work friends, and eventually I gave in once most people left, and then I just sat there and caught my daughter while she jumped off of stuff for a solid hour. It was fun, though.
So I don't want to get into dicey territory, but I know you gave the fellows a small gift, and I partner with Lindley to give fellows a small gift. I also give them a Christmas present, but what do you mind sharing what you gave them, or is it top secret?
Yeah, no, it's not top secret. It's actually part of the gift was the same book I gave last year's fellows, and I've given it to a lot of trainees, or if not the physical book, the recommendation, but it's a book by an NYU business professor named Scott Galloway, who I've quoted, I think, on this podcast before. Kind of a brash personality, more of a hot take kind of person, but he has a great book called The Algebra of Happiness, which I think is, it's not for everybody. His style is not for everybody, but it's an incredibly simple read. If anything, it will stir you to think about things and what's going to define, you know, happiness for you. So at this time of the year, I think it's great for anybody transitioning either from, you know, training into practice or, you know, at a point of uncertainty in their lives. I thought it was fantastic. And I know that you shared a book with them too.
I did. I will say first that I am a Scott Galloway fan. I read that book many years ago. And I have to say, I'm listening to his podcast and he has a joint podcast, that I listen to a little less than I used to, but I love The Algebra of Happiness. It's simple, it's spot on, and you always know where Professor Galloway stands, and I guess I would say that in a good way. I also pick a business school professor, and I think I shared this book with you at one point. I really, really like Clayton Christensen, who has passed away, Harvard Business School professor, and the book is How Will You Measure Your Life? And I've tried to get my wife to read it, and she starts, and you know, I guess it's just not for everyone, but I think it's so good.
Yeah, no, I remember when you brought that over and kindly gave me a copy, and I read it, and the lasting legacy of that book in our household is that we have a family mantra, which we started with the kids, but I often have to remind myself when I'm having a rougher time in clinic and in the OR that, and we have a sign in our kitchen that says this, in our family, we are kind, patient, and respectful. And a number of times that I've had my kids repeat it, that I've had to repeat it to myself because, you know, I asked them what they did today that was kind, patient, and respectful. And I hold myself accountable to that too. Now, those of you that have worked with me at times may say that maybe that's not always the case, but I do my best to hold every member of our family to that.
aspirational, just like your other mantra, we do hard things.
Oddly enough, the Peloton aphorisms have been leaking down into the family, and my 4-year-old daughter has started to say that she does hard things because, you know, we do. So that actually, before we get to our topic, I wanted to put you on the hot seat. How are you doing with your fitness journey that we've described so many times in this podcast?
Oh, this one, I think, thanks for asking. I think some in the listener group will appreciate this. So I am 52. I feel like I'm young at heart. I used to be, you know, everything revolved around sports, and as my body ages faster than my brain, I hope, I have had to give things up. So basketball is absolutely my favorite thing in the world to do. I don't play basketball anymore, but I have run a lot and I've been biking a lot and kind of just hitting the gym a little bit more, which is fantastic. Unfortunately, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I tore a meniscus and was hobbling around for a while. Got one of our partners to aspirate a bunch of fluid off my knee, give me some steroid, and I definitely feel better. I'm trying to avoid surgery, which every wise surgeon always tries to do. But I am back on the bike. I had a great ride today to work. And I came home, said hello to the family. Then I got back on the bike to ride to vote. It's a voting day in Missouri. And so all pretty good. All pretty good. And certainly the Peloton still plays a role.
That sounds great. You know, every time there was one of our physiatrists, Jeremy Hartman, who likes to play basketball and talks about playing basketball a lot. And he's like, yeah, every time everybody's like, yeah, Goldfarb can ball. Goldfarb can really ball. I was like, you know, nobody's seen it in a while. We're not quite sure, but you certainly have some Al Bundy-esque reputation around here. Many of the listeners may not understand the Al Bundy reference.
Yeah, I would say that's from the older days, Yep, unfortunately.
So we had a great submission to our mailbag, and I wanted to let anyone know if they have an episode suggestion. We're still working through some of the ones that we received within the last couple of months. But please send us a note, handpodcast@gmail.com. And this is one from Sahi, who just graduated from Hand Fellowship at North Carolina. So congratulations, and is joining the faculty at Loyola University in the fall. Great people up there. He really enjoys the Upper Hand podcast. So thank you, Sahi, for tuning in. So Sahi was wondering if we wouldn't mind discussing how residents, fellows, and young faculty can get involved with the various professional societies. So the Orthopedic Academy, the AOA, the Hand Society, the Hand Association, and for others, perhaps some of the plastic surgery societies too. It would be great to hear about your own involvement and experience, as well as advice for newcomers who want to get involved meaningfully, including committee and leadership opportunities. I know that some of the societies also do leadership and training courses and seminars, so would appreciate your thoughts on what's out there and what has been personally useful in your own careers. So, and then specifically calls you out, Chuck, for being a Bunnell Fellow, so talking about going abroad. And we know that Sahi has had fantastic mentors, including Glenn Gaston, who's been on the podcast recently, and Sahi shouts Glenn out here. But hopefully, you know, this is a question that you can answer for us, Chuck, and I'll contribute a little bit, perhaps.
Oh, I think you have a lot to contribute. And I would say that I don't want the therapists who are listening or the students who are listening to say, oh, this is not for me. I think the take homes from this is, you know, can be helpful for all. So first of all, what I've noticed trend wise is that every society that I'm involved with is concerned about membership and how to appeal to the younger generation, all of them. And it's an existential, I don't want to say crisis, but it's an existential discussion, because these societies have existed on volunteerism and, you know, just honestly contributions of time and money and expertise. And I think there's a little fear that may not continue in the future. So all societies are trying to figure out how to relate to younger potential members. And they're doing it in a lot of different ways. I'd stop there and say, do you agree with that?
Well, I mean, I think it's harder for me because I don't have as much of a memory of what, you know, what things were like in those professional societies because, you know, I'm younger than you, Chuck. So I just finished training, you know, less than 10 years ago.
Not yesterday and, anymore.
Yeah, I'm not the young guy anymore for sure. But yeah, I finished training 7 years ago. So, I kind of know the societies as they are now. Obviously the pandemic has affected things a lot in terms of how making people question, you know, the relevance of these not necessarily the societies themselves, but also the meetings that you would go to, the conferences you would commit yourself to. Do you automatically have to travel to these things now? And I think that people re-questioning the role of those things in their schedule is one that more immediately societies are going to have to deal with. But in terms of the you know, questioning the participation and the value of participating, I personally think, and we're both obviously biased, I think the Hand Society is really good at being in tune with what matters to members. And, you know, I think that they're a little more progressive with that than some of the other societies I've been involved with. I think it's something that, you know, generationally things are going to continue to change, and, you know, people's priorities may have shifted and refocused as we're emerging out of the pandemic now.
Yeah, and the role of webinars for education as opposed to formal society memberships and all that, you know, is in evolution right in front of our eyes. I still believe strongly in the role for these societies, but I wonder what it looks like in the future. I think getting involved early is really valuable. And a lot of the societies are, you know, providing avenues for early involvement, whether that's leadership programs or simple scholarships to attend the meetings. I know the Hand Study has that. The OTA has that. A lot of them have it. And the Orthopedic Academy has a resident forum, which is massive. And so I think all of these societies are looking for ways to get residents and fellows involved, because you get those people involved early and you want them to continue on. And that's great. I mean, that's absolutely great. And what the leaders of these societies are having to figure out is, you know, what do we provide that will make this a value add in a young member, young potential member's life? And some of the old stuff like closed societies, I don't think people are interested in that so much anymore. And formality is a little, you know, the Hand Study used to be a pretty darn formal society. Now it still is more than some, but it's not quite as formal as it used to be.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not not what it used to be. And I think that there are still some orthopedic subspecialties that have closed societies. So the Hip Society, the Knee Society, the ASCS, you know, I believe those are all closed. And I don't know how well that's going to stand in the next, you know, couple of decades. You know, to your point about, you know, residents being involved, if you're a resident, you know, that wants to be involved in organizations, the key is just, you know, getting an opportunity and showing up and doing the work. And you'll just continue to do that like Chuck Goldfarb, like a workman hammering nails, and you'll get noticed because it's a volunteer gig, as Chuck pointed out. So people will fade over time and people will get assigned to committees and not respond to emails and not show up for committee meetings and won't do the work. If you show up, you're interested, you talk to the committee chair and you get the work done, that will get around, because all of us are always looking for people to help us with stuff. And if Chuck Goldfarb is the person that gets the job done, we'll keep asking Chuck until he says no. So that honestly is the best way. And I think that it's good that, you know, a lot of organizations now have more accessible, they're putting residents on the formal committees. They develop the resident leadership group like the Academy does. So there's opportunities for people to show their stuff because very much before it was still, I wouldn't say nepotistic, but it was pretty darn close in terms of you had to kind of get, I guess the word to say now is sponsored, you know, in terms of getting there and, you know, being shown the, given the chance to show what you got.
I think that's really well said. And I would still think that, you know, having a sponsor that is a bigwig in whatever organization back you can make the path more, you know, can make it quicker, can make it, you know, advancement, so to speak, or involvement easier, but it is absolutely not required. And honestly, you don't have to have done a residency or fellowship with someone to develop a relationship in 2022, you know, email someone and just show an interest. So I would say, and I'm really going to echo Chris, there are two major principles for success. The first is, as Chris said, do the work. It's not hard. Like the committee, if you apply for a committee, get on the committee, engage, because there's going to be really smart people on that committee who will teach you something about life, about the committee work, whatever. Take it seriously, do what's asked, and you'll go far, which is just an incredibly low bar. And the second thing is apply for things besides committee. But, and here's the caveat, apply for things understanding that you may not get it. You may not get it the first time or the second time, and don't get discouraged. Try to learn from it. Try to grow from it. And just understand that sometimes you have to stand in line a little bit, which doesn't always appeal to me. And sometimes these things just take time, but the process will be valuable for you. Your name will get out there, and patience, it really is a virtue in these situations.
Yeah. I mean, there are just, you know, because we both know the Hand Society pretty well, there are a number of people that are on council now that literally just did exactly what you said. They went to committee meetings, they engaged with the chair, they did the work, then they became the committee chair. They did the work and then they became a division director. So it really is just showing up and doing the work, which again, sounds really super simple because it is, but it's a step that many of us don't pass through. I'm guilty of it on certain committees where I'm just not as engaged, where I end up probably not, you know, fulfilling the role that I was supposed to. And I try not to do that, but you know, as everybody's plate gets fuller and fuller, there are certain things that have to go by the wayside. You know, one piece of advice that I got, and I don't know how relevant it is now, and I don't know whether you were told this before, I was told to kind of pick two societies, like two groups, and just kind of say, I'm going to invest energy in these two, and see where it goes. And then reassess, you know, periodically saying, do I still want to invest energy? You know, there's one organization where I put some energy in and I always thought I wanted to be super involved in it. And, now I'm not. So I've kind of, you know, moved into a different area. So I don't know if that's advice that you give people or that you ever received.
Yeah. I mean, we can't do it all. And you know, I agree with you. You have to pick one, two, maybe three organizations to really dive deep. And, that's very fair advice. And don't make a mistake of thinking you're invaluable, no matter what position you're in. The work will get done with or without you. And it's really a question of, what can you get out of doing the work and meeting the people? And that's what I would follow with and say, you know, why? Why do Chris and I feel strongly about these organizations? Well, one is we enjoy teaching and we absolutely learn through these organizations. But the other is meeting people or developing a deeper relationship with people, again, who are super smart and super talented, have a different perspective, live in a different place. And it's really super fun to get to know people in a different way.
Yeah, it's all about, I mean, I think it's the relationships, one of the biggest things. You know, I guess it's, I don't want to say it's just networking, because I think that can carry a certain connotation, but it is getting to know people. And I think that that's one of the harder things about virtual meeting, committee meetings, you know, over the last 2.5 years. It's much easier to not pay attention, turn your video off when you have a Zoom meeting, you know, as opposed to when you're sitting across the table from somebody, they can tell when you're looking at your phone. So I think that I'm hoping, like, one of the things, I've been on the Hand Society's clinical grants review committee, and I've loved it. But I just wish that meeting was in person, because, you know, those interactions can be so rich. We can talk about academic work, you know, kind of really nerd out about stuff, but you just get to know people when you look them in the eye, when you're talking to them, you know, in the coffee breaks, et cetera, and the recreational activities. So I miss that. And I'm hoping that, as you know, hopefully things continue to improve or we get used to this normality, you know, we get back to that.
I'll share one observation that I have, and I hope some of the listeners disagree or see it differently, but one trend seems to be that people are going all in, and expecting and hoping to be leaders at a younger and younger age. And I find that fascinating, and I actually don't think it's ideal for two reasons. And far be it for me to judge others, but there's a reason that, you know, in your maybe mid-50s or potentially late 50s, you have a lot, you've learned a lot, you've interacted a lot. And I think you bring more to the table if you are a primary or you know, secondary leader of an organization. And the other part that I struggle with is family time. And if I'm truly engaged in an organization, this takes hours each week and it takes travel. And it takes you away from your family. So again, that's not for me to tell you or anyone else how to handle it. I just don't understand it. I don't think it's the right trend to see younger and younger leaders.
Yeah, no, I haven't thought about it that way, at least explicitly. But you know, I've started to question some of my time commitments, and really trying to refocus on the things that I think are appropriate for me and that bring me happiness. You know, right now, for me, it is enough of a challenge to balance, you know, an even, you know, a a practice that continues to get busier, a family life that continues to get busier with the kids, you know, being more aware of who's around and when they're around. And honestly, like sporting activities for the kids have started to pick up after school stuff. So it's just the treadmill keeps getting turned up in that regard. And then trying to manage my research program. And it's like, what other time is there? So I'm guilty of having to cancel a trip to a committee meeting, you know, that's coming up just because I just couldn't do it. It just didn't fit the calculus and I felt awful about it. But it just didn't work. So I get what you're saying. And I think that that is a truthful statement that is not going to sit well with many, but it will probably resonate with many more.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you get old like me and, you know, life gets easier at home. Right. My youngest is a senior in high school and it's just very different calculus, which again, just my two cents, but I hope some listeners comment on that.
The leadership programs, what do you think? That was one question that Sahi brought up. You know, the Hand Society has a young leaders program. We talked about the Academy doing a resident leaders program. There seem to be more, programs to develop people's leadership skills, perhaps in response to kind of that generational urge that you just discussed.
Yeah. So, and the AOA is another organization that it's interesting to watch the AOA who's done this for a long time. They do it really well. There's a resident leadership forum. There's a kind of a young member leadership forum and they do it really well. And of course the AOA is all about leadership. But the subspecialty societies are all doing it too now. And the Academy is getting into leadership. So leadership is a serious buzzword. And I think you can approach it in different ways. And you can get leadership education for many places on your home turf. If you're an academic institution, there's often an academic educator or academic leadership programs at your own institution with or without education built in. So a lot of different ways to go. They're not all the same, you know, they're not all the same at all. I am biased a bit. I think the AOA does it really well. It's not to say other organizations don't do it well, but again, it's somewhat become competitive because everyone's trying to have a shtick to attract young members and bring them in and not only teach them leadership, but then have them be leaders. And so I think we are lucky in a sense that we have a lot of different directions to learn.
Yeah, and I think that the Hand Society has taken a more experiential learning component to it with their young leaders program. At least when I did it a few years back, it was, you know, let's get together as a group. Let's facilitate some discussions. Let's dive into issues and your team will come up with, you know, a solution to a problem that is faced that the membership is facing. And then you'll also get to see how the council interacts. So no didactics there, but I thought that was an incredibly helpful and informative weekend. And then they also position their young leaders on committees. So you automatically have a foot in the door, which is nice. Versus the AOA on top of the resident leadership forum, the emerging leaders forum that they have at the annual meetings with, you know, specific presentations and didactics over a day or two. They also have this, you know, Apex leadership program, which is something that some of our partners and faculty at WashU have gone through. And I've heard great things, but it's heavily didactic and it feels like more like a business school camp type experience. And I haven't done that to this point and something that's intrigued me, but the thing that's held me back, to be very honest with you, is the time commitment right now. It just feels like a little bit much for me right now at this point in my life.
I think that's really well said. And it is interesting. And even in our department, we're trying to figure out ways to get younger faculty members on committees and on leadership discussions just for perspective. So it's really smart, I think, that all the societies are doing that because there's a valuable perspective in the simple recognition that young members bring a valuable approach that's different than the old guys, I think is great.
So are you backpedaling on your comments about how young people shouldn't be in leadership roles, Chuck?
No, not at all. I am simply saying that young people should be involved, but you know, decide carefully if you really want to get in that leadership treadmill where you're jumping and jumping to the ultimate leadership spot.
Yeah, it's funny. And when I was a medical student, very aspirational student, I knew the exact leadership roles in national societies and in department leadership that I wanted. And now I'm like, wow, I have really different opinions on that now. Once you get closer to the fire, you kind of see how it goes.
Yeah, for sure.
So Sahi asked about traveling fellowships, and you were selected for the very prestigious Sterling Bonnell Fellowship for the Hand Society. And I'm still completing my 2019 Gelberman Traveling Scholarship for the Hand Society. I'm almost done. I've got one more trip to go. So maybe you could provide some perspective on that. We also know there's different programs through, for example, the AOA's got a series of traveling fellowships. For any orthopedic residents, there's the Orthopedic Trauma has an traveling fellowship. Even the Peripheral Nerve Society now has a traveling fellowship. So what's your take on these opportunities?
Well, I would say two things. One, you don't need an award or an official traveling fellowship to travel and learn. It helps to have a mentor to put you in contact. But, you know, if you're willing to invest your own money, you will find willing hosts across this country and across the world. The benefit of the, quote, official traveling fellowships, the awards, is one, there's some prestige. Two, I think there's probably an easier path to find willing, wonderful hosts. And it can help set you on a path, which is fantastic. And the Bunnell Traveling Fellowship, which was now many years ago, was fantastic for me. I met people I didn't know. I considered carefully what I could learn from different people in different spots across the globe. And some people do, you know, a bunch of trips. I chose to do three really primary trips, and it was fantastic. And I'm still friends with those people today, and I still consider them mentors. And so I think if you, you know, it's certainly easier in academics to focus on things like that, because it does take you away from practice. It was really a great experience. I think despite your COVID delays, you would agree with much of what I've said.
Yeah, the Gelberman Traveling Fellowship has been fantastic. And, you know, I was fortunate enough when I was starting on as a faculty, Dr. Gelberman himself also granted me some funds and some time, most importantly, to travel. And I think that was definitely a career catalyst and accelerant. I think that when you do it, depends on what you want to get out of it. The temptation is to do it right after finishing fellowship. I think you're not going to learn as much, to be very honest with you. I think that, you know, you personally will grow more if you start in practice, kind of see how you do things, then take a trip, and then keep doing stuff, and then take a trip, assuming you have the time and the funds to do something like that. I'd spread it out a bit, because you're going to get so much more out of it after you see how you want to do things, after you experience some of the challenges and you know the right questions to ask. I'll be very honest with you. I don't need to scrub in when I go to these places, because that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for picking a brain during the coffee in the surgeon's lounge, asking about, what indications are and, you know, what their experience has been, stuff that you're not going to get when somebody writes an article, when they talk on the podium. And yes, of course, there are a lot of really cool technical things that you learn, but that's not the primary reason for going. You know, so there are traveling fellowships like that, which you can set up on your own, or you can get through a society. There are other traveling fellowships that are more group-based. So you're part of a cohort, you know, say, for example, the North American Traveling Fellowship for the AOA, or the American British Canadian Fellowship through the AOA. And you go as a cohort for like a solid 4 to 6 weeks. Which is a huge time commitment, huge ask of your partners, and most importantly, of your family. I remember during one of my monthly mentoring meetings with Ken Yamaguchi, he said, "Chris, you got to do this." The next month that we met, he said, "Okay, so how's your North American fellowship application coming on?" I said, "I asked my wife, Ken. It's a no go. There's no way I'm doing that." And he's like, "You are absolutely right to not apply then."
I don't want to, again, project. It feels generational to me. It was a no-go for me. As much as it would have been great, I couldn't ask that of my wife, and I had kids. It's a lot, but there's no doubt you really develop close bonds with people. The people who've done the ABC or the North American, you know, speak volumes about it and really rave about the experience. But it takes the right person and the right setting and the right support to do it. So it's good for some, maybe not good for all.
Yeah, it's great for developing what we would call now a brand, in terms of what you're known for, because you have to give a talk when you go to these, visiting various institutions when you travel as a group. And all of a sudden you're known as, so-and-so person who really studies this topic. So it's good for that. There are clearly different ways to do that in 2022, but it is good to mix old and new techniques. So I think we've tried to answer Sahi's question as much as we can. If any listeners want to, give their suggestions, feel free to let us know on social or send us an email, handpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll be definitely sharing those as pearls come in.
I love it. Thank you, and good to see you as always. Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.